A four-letter word, not often talked about in polite company, yet oh so critical to the global economy. Cash. People, I'm talking about cash. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 29th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, one of the services that we provide to you, the listeners of this program, is doing the heavy lifting, the careful analysis of this indicator or that, the slogging through corporate earnings reports in search of a tidbit, the putting together of 2 + 2 to make sense of the bigger picture. And more often than not, that pays off. And today, that is an especially apt phrase because a review of corporate profit reports the past 24 hours or so shows that companies are swimming in cash. Apple and GE and McDonald's all reported strong cash flow and quite healthy, thank you very much, cash balances. So for a little bit of expert insight, we've called Campbell Harvey. He's a professor of finance at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Professor, welcome to the program.
Great to be on, Kai.
Can we assume, to paraphrase Gordon Gekko here, that cash is good?
Cash is very good right now. Given this business cycle is so long, 129 months, the longest since the 1850s, the probability of a slowdown or recession is high, and companies want to hedge that.
And so they just keep cash on hand and in the bank, as it were.
Yeah. So we recently did a survey of 400 CFOs, and 60% of them are strengthening their balance sheet because over half believe that a slowdown or recession is going to start in 2020. So cash is one thing that you can do. And of course, another thing, you could slow down your hiring.
Yeah. Well, so let's get to that and where this cash goes. Wages specifically. As we've seen, wages have started the past couple of years to increase a little bit, flattening the past year or so. With all this cash around, companies could, in theory, be paying more.
They could in the short term. And this is really important to realize that the reason that they're hoarding the cash is that when the recession occurs, they don't need to slash employment. To slash employment is very costly, and then to hire people back is very costly. So it's better to have that cushion so that the impact on employment is minimal.
Of course, the wage thing has been going on for a very long time now, right? So that argument gets a little long in the tooth, much as this expansion does.
It does.
Yeah. One hates to pick on Apple, but since they do have $207 billion in cash, why do they have that much money in cash? I mean, what other things could they be doing with it?
So Apple obviously is a complicated case, and it's a huge amount of cash. But any company that is sensitive to the business cycle. So some companies are not. So if you're in the healthcare sector, mm-hmm. you're not as sensitive to a recession. People are going to get sick no matter what the economic situation is. But companies that are sensitive might need that cushion. And I'm not saying that Apple needs $200 billion of cash. Yeah. I'm saying more generally that these economically sensitive firms need that cushion so they don't need to take drastic measures that they don't want to take, for example, slashing employment.
You know, it's really interesting. I'm not sure that I expected when I sat down for this interview with you that it would go from, yay, cash is good, but ooh, it's not great that they're stockpiling it because they're worried about a recession. That's kind of an interesting twist.
This is different in 2020 versus 2007. So they were surprised in 2007. They improvised. They cut too many people in the end. Whereas this time, this cash, they're actively doing risk management. Mm. So they're preparing for the possibility. And the good thing here is if a recession does hit, given this cushion, the odds are it's going to be a soft landing. And I think we all want a soft landing.
Man, there's that R word again. Campbell Harvey is a professor of finance at the Duke Fuqua School of Business. Professor Harvey, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It is a rare Federal Reserve meeting day indeed, as today happens to be, where Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed are not the lead story on this program. But really, It's kind of same with the Fed these days. Economy's good, Chair Powell says. Inflation's low. We'll wait to see what the data says. Oh, and the labor market?
I think we've learned quite a lot of good things about the labor market, good things suggesting that there's been more room to run.
So there's that. He's got his eye on the coronavirus, still a little worried about trade. I mean, same, right? Wall Street, though, as it always does, wanted a little more love from the central bank. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the new NAFTA, USMCA, officially signed today and that partial China deal from a week or two ago, calmer trade times are perhaps upon us. But there is still plenty of tariffing going on out there. American distillers, purveyors of fine bourbons and whiskeys, for instance, are in Europe this week trying to get the EU to lift its 25% tariffs on their products, as are makers of Scotch and Irish whiskeys trying to get American tariffs on their goods lifted. Not on the Trump administration's tariff list, though, English whiskey. And that could help that lesser-known libation break into the American market. Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard somehow drew that assignment.
Andrew Nelstrop prepares to taste a nip of English whiskey. He wets his lips and flares his nostrils.
It doesn't have much on the nose at all. And even when I take my first mouthful, I don't get that much smoke. But wait 10 seconds, this smoke appears. It's got a good mouth feel to it.
For a whiskey buff like Nelstrop, that is praise indeed, and not entirely surprising. After all, this is whiskey from his own distillery. When he built it in 2006, it was the only one in England, the first since the industry died out here 100 years ago. The distillery sits amid the finest barley-growing land in the country, on top of a huge aquifer.
It's England's largest freshwater supply, and crystal clear. Absolutely beautiful.
Even more important, he says, the casks are stored in warehouses in wide-open countryside.
If you look out this back window where the warehouses are, you cannot see the next building. It's just meadows, river, plains, and trees as far as I can see. And I think it's more about where your casks are maturing and breathing.
His company is a success, so much so that 13 rival firms have now set up whisky distilleries across England. Nelstrop is keen to expand his sales overseas. He's chosen an interesting time to try to break into the American market.
If President Trump slaps his tariffs on Scotch and Irish whisky, that could be a bit of a boost for you. That'll give you a price advantage.
Yes. I mean, in theory, it should be good for us.
His whisky isn't cheap. It'll sell in the US at around $55 a bottle, more expensive than entry-level Scotch. I've come here to the UK's largest online whisky retailer, the Whisky Exchange, in London. Head buyer Dawn Davies told me the English spirit is also at a disadvantage when it comes to image.
People have this romantic idea about Scotland and the Highlands and that picture of a Scottish glen and a loch, you know, and I think that helps that Scottish image worldwide. England doesn't quite have that romance.
Or volume when it comes to whisky. Scotland exports 137 million bottles of Scotch a year to the US alone. The St. George's distillery makes only 160,000 bottles in total.
It's never realistically going to challenge Scotch, though, is it?
Look, you never know. Say, let's take English sparkling wine. Could it challenge champagne? Potentially. You know, the quality's there. They haven't got the history, but, you know, the sales are growing. More people are knowing about it.
Back in Norfolk, another group of Brits is getting to know more about English whisky with a tour of the distillery and a tasting.
By all means, have a taste. Once again, don't drink it all. Or spill it.
And the verdict from these visitors, John Burrell and David and Adam Smith, is positive.
Yes, very nice, yeah. It's absolutely lovely.
Explodes round the mouth.
Very tasty, yeah.
It's a lot easier to drink. It's a lot smoother. It's a lot nicer, in my opinion.
What, than Scotch?
I prefer it, yeah. I much prefer it.
But these are patriotic English drinkers. We'll soon find out whether it appeals to impartial American palates. At the St. George's Distillery in Norfolk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Warren Buffett has owned his hometown newspaper, the Omaha World Herald, for almost 9 years now. He's been in the newspaper business for more than 40. But no more. The billionaire lover of local newspapers is famous, of course, for his savvy investments and for almost never selling off an investment that is making money, which kind of gives away what I'm about to say. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway holding company, we learned today, is selling off all of its newspapers. So if even Warren Buffett is admitting he can't make money in papers, what hope is there? Marketplace's Jack Stewart has been gathering some opinions on that one.
Berkshire Hathaway is selling Buffett's accumulation of over 30 daily papers, dozens of weeklies, and their digital operations for $140 million. That includes the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and Buffett's hometown paper, the Omaha World Herald.
It struck me as one more nail in the coffin of the old ownership of newspapers.
Bill Gruskin is at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. He says Buffett is famous for his long-term value investments.
So the fact that he's getting out of the newspaper business is one more negative signal for the future of local newspapers as we've known them.
The buyer, Lee Enterprises, has already been managing most of the papers for Berkshire Hathaway since 2018. It says it sees up to $25 million in cost savings in this deal. Rick Edmonds is the media business analyst at the Poynter Institute.
The consolidation like the one happening today gives the industry some breathing room. There are some efficiencies once you put two companies together.
That's what Gannett, parent of USA Today, and New Media Investment Group said that they were looking for when they merged to create the largest newspaper group in the US last year. Local newspapers have been suffering for years. Craigslist wiped out pages of paid print classifieds. Social media sucked up lucrative local ads. And it's only getting tougher to fight for a slice of a household's media budget, says Joshua Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard.
You know, now you're paying $13 a month for Netflix. You're paying $7 or $8 for Disney Plus. All these other monthly subscription products are making people look at the, you know, substantial amount of money in many cases they're paying for their daily print newspaper and saying, you know what, we can just look at our phones.
In a statement today, Warren Buffett said, "I am confident our newspapers will be in the right hands going forward." I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
A quick corporate earnings update as we go on. Boeing reported today, as expected, the 737 MAX has cost that company billions, $18.6 billion to be exact. That in turn led to the plane maker's first annual loss in more than 20 years. Capitalism being capitalism, though, Boeing shares up 1.7% today with that Band-Aid ripped off. Starbucks reported yesterday, better than expected is the lingo. One reason? Sales of cold beverages like nitro cold brew and somehow even something called pumpkin cream cold brew, whatever that is. Those sales have been hot and a nice little pick-me-up for afternoon sales, typically a sleepy time for coffee joints. Afternoons, it turns out, are kind of a dead zone for a lot of food retailers. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on what some of them are doing to drum up business.
Getting consumers to spend between lunch and dinner has been a perennial challenge for restaurants, says consumer strategist R.J. Hottovy with Morningstar. I mean, that's why we have happy hour, right?
Traditionally speaking, it's been more some sort of coupon or discount to drive people back in the afternoon.
Starbucks actually tried that approach for a while, offering discounts to morning customers if they returned the same day. But it wasn't all that effective until Starbucks found that sweet spot for menu items with special appeal in the afternoon.
It's the idea of snacking.
Alex Suskin teaches food and beverage management at Cornell, and he's seen a rush by restaurants in recent years to better cater to the growing appetite for small bites and pick-me-ups.
So it has to be something that they maybe can't normally get or they wouldn't normally get in the morning or in the regular, evening period.
From iced blended coffee drinks to absurd sounding limited edition fast food offerings like Dunkin's Donut Fries or Burger King's Mac and Cheetos.
Cheetos flavor on the outside, creamy mac and cheese on the inside.
If that's not your idea of delicious, health and wellness foods are also driving afternoon sales, says Trevor Boomstra, a restaurant industry consultant with Alex Partners.
So you do see the kind of fizzy tea drinks being very popular, including like cold pressed juices as well. Sometimes energy drinks when people are looking for that recharge in the afternoon.
That's exactly where Starbucks has had success, offering that hit of afternoon energy with cold brews. And Boomstra says even if retailers can't get people into stores in the afternoon, they can bring the stores to consumers with more mobile ordering and delivery. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Circling back to Starbucks real quick, earnings next quarter may well not be better than expected. The company said in its earnings announcement yesterday that it has closed more than half of its 4,000 stores in China because of the coronavirus. Coming up.
So there's at least 46 bans right now.
Turns out not everything is legal in Jersey. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 11 today, less than a tenth percent, closed at 28,734. The NASDAQ edged up 5 points, also less than a tenth percent, 92.75. The S&P 500 shaved off 2 points, under a tenth percent, 32.73. Got to tell you, they were higher by a bunch before Jay Powell started talking. Boeing, we talked about, shares up 1.7%, that despite a loss of $636 million in 2019. Apple beat the street on earnings and revenue and rose 2% today. Just heard from Jack about Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway getting out of the newspaper business. Buffett said the owner of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, that would be Lee Enterprises, to which he sold, is best positioned to help those papers thrive. Lee shares up a whopping 66%. Berkshire Hathaway take up a 10%. Berkshire A shares, by the way, Berkshire Hathaway A, BRKA, $336,476 a piece. No, that is not a typo. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority did its annual count of the county's homeless last week. The results won't be out till later this year, but the count a year ago came to 58,936, which includes more than 16,000 people living in their cars and in their vans and RVs. That's the backdrop for this next installment in of our series, Adventures in Housing, about all the ways that people find shelter in this economy.
My name is Jeremiah Othin. I work for a restaurant as a cook and also as like a food delivery. For the last 6 months, I've been living in my car. Oh, an apartment costs like a one bedroom for $1,300, $1,400. But if you put on the bills, I have to pay everything, it comes maybe like to $1,600. So I realized an apartment, to save more money, to do what I wanted to do, an apartment, it wasn't that essential to me. I worked like 2 jobs, long hours, so I barely stayed at the apartment. I worked like 6 days a week, so I was like, imagine I'm paying rent to a place I don't stay in even. So that's when I decided the car option. Yeah, at first I hated it, but sometimes you're like, anyway, you know, this is it. Some of the places that I park my car are like casinos, hospitals. Some places I go park in the employee section, so they think I'm an employee over. So I go there like 3 days, then I go to another one like 2 days, then I go to another one. I have like 4 main parking spots that I use. I always park facing the wall so that even security or anybody can't see me. I gotta hide. I do have a gym membership that helps me to take a shower. That's the main thing I have it for. Because getting a clean shower when you're napping in the car is really hard. So the gym is the best alternative for a clean shower. It costs me $20 a month. There's gyms in the city that give out towels, but they are crowded. Everybody's in there just to take a shower. In the end, you realize, like, the most important thing is taking care of myself. You know, like, before, I would just buy clothes, shoes. But right now, I'm like, I don't even need many shoes. I just need 3 pairs of shoes. I'm just experiencing something I never thought I'd experience to survive.
That's Jeremiah Othin living in his car here in L.A. A little bit more than a month from now, March the 1st, New York is going to become the 8th state in the union to implement a ban on single-use plastic bags, joining, among others, California, Oregon, and Hawaii. Interestingly enough, though, there is a longer list of states that have bans on plastic bag bans. Try to say that 10 times fast. It's a ban on plastic bag bans. Samantha Maldonado and her colleagues at Politico have done a bunch of work on the plastic bag lobby. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll get to the bans and the lobbying and all of this in a second. But talk to me for a second about the plastic bag business as a business, would you?
Sure. So the plastic bag business is obviously found in every state federally and also in foreign markets as well. It's a growing business, and it's one that is sort of facing some foes and environmentalists right now.
And yet, as you point out in this piece, only 8 states have been able to successfully ban one-use plastic bags. How come?
Well, that's right. So 8 states have banned plastic bags. Other states, 14 in fact, have laws that prohibit local governments from instituting their own plastic bag bans. And that's because lobbying is really strong. The plastic bag industry has a group called the American Progressive Bag Alliance. They're a division of the Plastics Industry Association, and they're pretty strong. They make an argument that plastic bags are actually better for the environment than paper, or that there'll be adverse impacts on retailers and customers if bags aren't banned.
Backed up by science, these claims are, one has to imagine?
Well, there's been studies going both ways.
Yeah. As sometimes happens. What has the fight been for environmental groups? I mean, they've been lobbying long and hard with limited success. Is it just, are they outmatched? Is that the deal?
Well, that's part of the deal. So they'll always have more boots on the ground at the local level. And that's where you see a lot of the bans actually being instituted, or any of the other sort of laws that either put a fee on plastic bags or ban single-waste plastic or limit it. And that's happening at the local level where, as I said, they have boots on the ground, but also where sort of big money lobbyists don't have as much influence.
Right. And those big money lobbyists go to the state houses, and that's because that's where the votes are.
Exactly.
These states that have bans on bans, that is to say the 14 states that prevent local jurisdictions from enacting bans, what are the rationales there?
Sure. Well, for the most part, it's just they say it will create a uniform standard across the state. This is also, ironically, a reason that a lot of retail associations and customers at some points come to states in which municipalities have instituted bag bans, because they complain that there's no uniform standard.
Yeah. New Jersey, which is your area of expertise, the energy and environment beat there. What happened to the bag ban there?
Well, it died. It's a long time coming. This is not the first time it dies. But this death was sort of unexpected if you had asked someone maybe in the middle of the legislative session. The previous legislative session, the Senate and the Assembly actually passed a bag ban, but the governor vetoed it because he said it didn't go far enough. Another bill was introduced. It was even stricter. It would have been the strictest in the country had it passed. It would have banned plastic bags, paper bags, and polystyrene food containers. And the Senate passed it, but the Assembly did not take it up for a vote. So by tomorrow at this time, it should be reintroduced in the Senate.
So despite that state failure of the ban, New Jersey is a really good example of how this works, right? Because there are still a bunch of local bans in place in that state.
That's right. So there's at least 46 bans right now. And the environmentalists, a lot of them say, okay, if we can't get a state ban passed, that's all right. The localities will step up and they have their own bans in place or other limits.
Samantha Maldonado covers energy and environment in the great state of New Jersey for Politico. Samantha, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, in which the long, strange saga of MoviePass is finally over. Remember, that was the company that had the pay one low price, see as many movies as you want plan. Didn't work out for a bunch of self-evident reasons, and that's despite a whole lot of variations and permutations, and the service closed down back in September. Anyway, today it formally filed for bankruptcy protection, as did its parent company Helios and Matheson Analytics. Chapter 7, by the way, the sell it all off, we're really done chapter, not 11, the let's see if we can't keep it going chapter. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 11 today, less than a 10%. NASDAQ up 5, also less than a 10th. S&P 500 shaved off 2, also less than a 10%. Thanks, Jay Powell. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.